Clinical research on systemic management of colorectal cancer has exploded in the last few years, including not only refinement of the use of chemotherapy, but the introduction of biologic agents. I met with Dr. Randy Hecht for his take on where we are and where we're headed, and he began our conversation by putting the field in perspective.
The treatment of colorectal cancer, to a certain extent, is kind of taking a deep breath right about now. We've had a huge amount of progress over the last 5 years, going from one or two agents to multiple agents. We have two pathways that definitely seem to be important, the VEGF pathway with angiogenesis and the EGFR pathway. We have three cytotoxic drugs that clearly help improve survival and improve quality of life. What we don't know is we don't know the best ways to use these drugs. We don't know the best patients to use these drugs in. We don't know the best ways to combine these drugs. And to be honest, we're actively looking for new targets because we don't want to spend the next 20 years basically fiddling with the same targets that we already have, because that would be very depressing. We've increased the life expectancy of someone with colorectal cancer. I'm sure you're familiar with this, is that from a best supportive care time, you know, a decade ago or even a little longer, from 6 months to 20 months with cytotoxics, probably pushing 24 months with targeted agents. But we're not curing a lot of people. The only people we do cure are people who go to surgery, which is kind of another important area and a hot area in colorectal cancer, and perhaps there is an overlap in that we may be able to send more people to surgery with better therapies. So in colorectal cancer, when we last spoke, the things that had come out and that were important were, one, that the use of all three cytotoxic drugs is probably a good thing, and that patients who do get all three cytotoxic drugs, and this was spearheaded by Axel Grothe, the Mayo Clinic, together with Dan Sargent, showing that patients who get all three drugs, and in trials where they get all three drugs, tend to live longer than patients who don't.
You're talking about a metastatic disease, of course.
This is purely metastatic disease. The other things that we've learned is that bevacizumab added to IFL, the old obsolete regimen, is better than IFL alone. We've learned that probably when you give continuous infusion 5-FU, it doesn't really matter from an efficacy standpoint whether you give oxaliplatin or whether you give irinotecan. We've also learned that epidermal growth factor receptor antibodies have some efficacy, and cetuximab was approved several years ago, that as a single agent, it has roughly about a 10% response rate. Together with irinotecan and irinotecan refractory patients, it has about a 20% response rate. So what's happened since then in metastatic disease? Well, over the last several years, we've had one large trial, which I was involved with, which is the CONFIRM-1 trial, as well as the CONFIRM-2 trial, looking at small molecule VEGF inhibitors. And those trials were negative when it came to progression-free survival, which was a disappointment. This is downstream of bevacizumab. So bevacizumab binds to the ligand. These bind to the receptor, to the VEGF receptors. What was interesting, though, was that there was a subgroup of patients who had high LDH, which may be for the first time allowing us to target anti-angiogenesis. And it's possible that patients who have high LDH, which is a bad prognostic sign, may actually have angiogenesis-driven tumors. And in fact, both trials showed that most of the benefit that was seen, of any benefit that was seen, was in high LDH patients. So something that's interesting, particularly for the development of small molecule inhibitors of VEGF. The other data that's come out that's interesting, there are really two trials that have been particularly interesting over the past year, a little over a year. One has been the arrival of panitumumab, also known as Vectibix. Panitumumab is a fully human antibody against the epidermal growth factor receptor. Actually, it binds very avidly. Since it is fully human, it would be hoped that it would have fewer infusion reactions, and it does appear to have relatively few infusion reactions, can be given without premedications, though it has never been compared head-to-head with cetuximab or Erbitux to really look at infusion reactions. In the trials that were done over the past several years, there was a phase 2 trial which I ran. The 05 trial showed that same 10%, roughly 10%, patients who ended up with a response, and some people with stable disease. Really, the seminal trial was Mark Peters' trial, which was presented at AACR last year. That was the trial that could not be done in the United States because cetuximab was already approved here, and it was versus best supportive care. Best supportive care trials generally are not really looked upon highly in the United States, and since it was an alternative drug, it would have been unethical. In that study, patients who had failed chemotherapy were randomized to receive either panitumumab every other week or best supportive care. And there was a major improvement in progression-free survival. There was also this roughly 10% response rate that had been seen. And in fact, when you crossed over the patients who got placebo, they had roughly the same response rate. There was no increase in overall survival because they crossed over. But the difference in progression-free survival was highly significant. And in fact, the best way, I think, really to look at those curves is that at the first look, which was at 2 months, there were approximately 50% of people left on the panitumumab arm, but only 30% left on the best supportive care arm, which was also interesting because we didn't realize how rapidly these patients progressed. And that 20% seems to carry on for the next several CT scans, showing that this is probably a group that gets a lot of benefit. What we don't know is how to choose those patients who are going to benefit the most. The other two trials that are probably the most important trials in metastatic disease have been two frontline trials, one of which was not completed, and the other one, which was just the data was released at ESMO, and some more updated data will be discussed by Len Saltz. The first one was the CILGB intergroup trial, which was presented by Alan Vanuk. The trial that Alan ran was a trial of either FOLFOX or FOLFIRI, which are probably equivalent. And in fact, in the successor trial, they didn't even randomize for that. And then patients were randomized to either cetuximab or no cetuximab. And that trial could not finish accrual because bevacizumab became available. And once Avastin was available, it became very difficult to get people onto these trials. And the data that he presented was very interesting. And on one hand, the response rates appeared to be higher. In this relatively small number of patients, however, progression-free survival, which may be more important, did not appear to be greatly increased. Okay, I'm actually going to skip to another study from there, which has only been presented in the lowest of forms, which is by press release, which is the CRYSTAL trial. And the CRYSTAL trial was a randomized trial done in Europe. Patients were treated with either FOLFIRI and cetuximab or FOLFIRI alone. And as far as we can tell from what's been, you know, the limited amount that's been given out in the press release, there did seem to be a significant improvement in progression-free survival. So this hints that perhaps adding an EGFR agent, an anti-EGFR agent, an anti-EGFR antibody up front may improve outcome. Now, there are two trials that will look at this, and neither of them have data back yet. There's the PACE trial, which I'm running, of which the main arm is FOLFOX with bevacizumab, with or without panitumumab. And progression-free survival is the primary endpoint for that study. It's an 800-patient cohort. That's the primary analysis, and the results should be back this year. The other trial is actually the son of the one that I discussed earlier, the CALGB SWOG trial, which Alan Vanuk is running again. That is a large trial, dealer's choice, FOLFOX or FOLFIRI. They don't think that's a question that's important. And then the patients are randomized to one of three arms, bevacizumab, cetuximab, or combination. I understand that they're accruing relatively slowly. That's a large trial with a survival endpoint. While I hope that they were able to finish accrual, it's a big trial, and overall survival is a difficult hurdle. Now, the other trial also, just so you think about that, that's hovering over this whole thing is the Cassidy trial. That was a trial looking initially at Zelox versus FOLFOX. In that study, then bevacizumab was added. So it became, in effect, a 2x2 with FOLFOX versus Zelox with or without bevacizumab. And they did reach the endpoint that they had wanted to, showing that Zelox was not inferior to FOLFOX. They were very similar. The other thing that was looked at was looking at progression-free survival was a fluoropyrimidine oxaliplatin-containing chemotherapy with or without bevacizumab. And in that, there was a statistically significant improvement in progression-free survival, but not anywhere near what we had expected. And the hazard ratio was approximately 0.83, with a fairly small improvement in median survival. In fact, in unplanned subgroup analyses, the FOLFOX arm, which is the most common arm, actually did not have a significant improvement in progression-free survival. But that's an unplanned analysis. When you add them all together, there was. So one of the questions has been, why do we have this result, which is very different than when FOLFOX plus Bev was seen in the second line? Is there something different? Did the Europeans do something different? Did they treat their patients differently? Is this an opening for other drugs that may, you know, be used in the first line, that perhaps that the very powerful, you know, improvement in progression-free and actually overall survival that was seen in second line with the ECOG 3200 trial maybe that's not seen in the frontline trial. So this is, I'm really anxious to see what additional data is going to be presented.
One of the things that they've pointed out is one difference between the IFL-BEV trial and their study was that in the IFL-BEV study, the patients had toxicity from chemotherapy and then it was stopped. The BEV was continued until progression. Whereas in the 66 study, when patients were having toxicity from the therapy, everything was stopped, including the BEV. So the patients ended up getting less BEV.
I really would like to see, as I said, I'm anxious to see the numbers. And that's been one of the interpretations of the data. And the problem is the data is the data. The question is, why is the data the data? And what I would like to see would be, you know, more information about that. I think part of this also, there's a whole other flavor that's going on in first-line metastatic colorectal cancer, which is the idea of the chemo-free interval or chemotherapy holiday, which is based on work by Aimery Desgrammat, initially the OptimOx trial, which had some problems on its own with trying to get the investigators to do what he wanted them to do, or patients who were initially treated with a fixed period of 5-FU and oxaliplatin and switched to 5-FU alone, and then they could cycle back. And then OptimOx 2, which was presented, I believe, last year at ASCO, where patients actually had a chemotherapy-free interval. But there's some other unusual things about that. I think the idea of a chemotherapy-free interval may be more prevalent in Europe than it is in the United States. But, you know, the question is that, you know, that may have played a role in that. But it's hard for me to say that that's the explanation for the data. And I think, once again, the data is the data. Hopefully, the investigators were instructed on how to do the trial, and they were instructed on continuing the bevacizumab. They were instructed, or perhaps 5-FU and bevacizumab. Since I wasn't part of the trial, it's a little bit harder for me to comment on it. I have heard that as well.
Let's pick up on a bunch of those points that you brought out, starting with the issue of double antibody therapy. Where are we right now in terms of the issue of safety of this approach as well as efficacy?
There is actually remarkably little data with double antibody approaches to the treatment of metastatic cancer. It's intellectually appealing. The antibodies should not have any PK interactions being antibodies. The antibodies should not really have overlapping toxicity as far as we know, but there are always unexpected toxicities. And as we found out, for example, with trastuzumab, Herceptin, and cardiac toxicity, for example. But the best data that we have is actually getting a few years ago, which is the so-called BOM-2 trial, where the response rate, and once again, it was just response rate in a randomized phase 2, was higher than the 10% that we would normally see with cetuximab. It was around 20% with the combination of bevacizumab and cetuximab in bevacizumab-naive patients. Once again, a population that really no longer exists, or at least is not very common in the United States. So that's basically about it. The PACE data and the CALGB safety data will be the largest data set really at looking at this. And we're interested in finding out what the safety data looks like.
What have we learned in the last year or so about the safety of panitumumab?
Well, I think that on one hand, panitumumab is an anti-EGFR antibody. And like most anti-EGFR antibodies, there is one that claims that nemotuzumab, where it's claimed that there's no rash. But of the ones that have been looked at most, which is cetuximab, panitumumab, and mituzumab, that all of them, in effect, are on target, and the target being the epidermal growth factor receptor in the skin. So skin and skin-related toxicities are found in virtually all patients. On the other hand, very few patients end up coming off of panitumumab due to the skin or various integumentary toxicity. The incidence of infusion reactions has been quite small. And in fact, in a series of 920 pooled patients that was presented at ESMO this past year, there were only 4 infusion reactions, if I remember correctly. One of the problems with trying to compare also infusion reactions from one study to another is that the definitions often vary from study to study. But I would say that it seems to be a safe drug. The other on-target toxicity that's been seen that's been increasingly appreciated, not just for panitumumab, but also for cetuximab, and I assume for the other antibodies as well, has been hypomagnesemia. Now, we don't routinely look for hypomagnesemia. It's not usually on our chemistry panels, but, you know, up to 20% or higher of patients will get grade 3-4 hypomagnesemia, and these people can have profound fatigue. It's unclear what the best way to treat these. There's some questions about high doses IV actually leading to more renal wasting Oral agents are somewhat difficult to give. And I think this is actually a field where we really need the help of our friends, the nephrologists.
That's interesting. What are the symptoms that patients have?
Well, it's really more fatigue. They can also get hypocalcemia as well. It's not like the skin rash, which you can see. And it's difficult to tell. The other problem is, of course, patients with refractory colon cancer who are getting third-line therapy who have widespread metastatic disease can often be fatigued. But I really think this is over and above. And I think it really is important that patients who are on any of these drugs to make certain that the magnesium is checked. I'm not saying it has to be checked every week, but I think that it needs to be checked periodically because this is something. And in fact, the longer that you stay on these drugs, the higher the incidence of hypomagnesemia.
What's the mechanism of action?
You're asking an oncologist about biology. From what I understand, it's actually the epidermal growth factor receptor has multiple tasks in the body. And apparently there are high levels found in the loop of Henle. And it probably has something to do with reabsorption of magnesium in the kidney. And so by blocking that, you end up with magnesium wasting. One of the things that I would really like to see would be to see a well-done, you know, set of physiology trials done by nephrologists to help us, you know, try to treat them. We all have some ideas perhaps how to treat them, but none of them have been looked at in any sort of randomized fashion.
You mentioned the infusion or the lack of infusion reactions with panitumumab, and that's created increasing interest in terms of what the incidence of infusion reactions is with cetuximab. And you hear debates about that, and people like Rich Goldberg and Jordan Berlin say, well, we see a lot of infusion reactions with cetuximab, and then a lot of other people say, well, we never see infusion reactions. What are your thoughts on that debate?
Well, I think part of it's your definition of infusion reaction. For example, in some of the trials that we do with panitumumab, any adverse reaction within a certain period of time was considered, you know, any complaint in effect was considered an infusion reaction. Other trials really look at anaphylaxis, you know, for an infusion reaction. That being said, particularly for those two people in the Mid-South, the question has come up, which is fascinating, is that they report a much higher incidence of infusion reactions to cetuximab. I'm not aware of this with panitumumab, but, you know, particularly in the Mid-South, having a very high incidence. And I'll be honest, you know, I don't think that the ethnic groups are really that different there than in the rest of the country. And I don't have a good answer for that. These are both excellent investigators. I know them both very well. I know they're probably good at collecting it, but I can't believe that that's all that it is. I don't know. Something in the water table, but I really don't have a good explanation for that. It really becomes comparing apples to oranges when you're comparing these sorts of trials. I think that the incidence of severe reactions, which are the ones that are important with cetuximab, are fairly uncommon. My gut feeling is that they're probably somewhat less common with panitumumab, but it's difficult to compare trial to trial.
What do you see as the current non-protocol role of panitumumab right now?
Well, as you know, panitumumab was approved based on the Peters data. It was approved in EGFR-positive patients because in that study you had to have at least 1% EGFR-positive in patients who had failed 5-FU irinotecan and oxaliplatin. And that's the label. Now, there are a couple of things that I think that you could reasonably go beyond the label. One trial that we're updating, which is the 250 trial, actually there were two studies, the 167 and the 250 trials. One trial run by Jordan Berlin, patients who had 10% or higher EGFR level, percent of cells that were stained, went on the 167. Patients who had less than 10% went on the 250 trial. So there were basically two trials, the same group of patients. What's been shown in the past, both with cetuximab as well as with panitumumab, in our trials with panitumumab, is that the amount of EGFR staining, which it is not like HER2, that it does not seem to make any difference whether or not you have high staining amount of staining or low amount of staining. There have been case reports of people getting responses with cetuximab who are EGFR negative. And in fact, this trial, the 250 trial, was designed to actually specifically look at this. And in the preliminary data that we had presented, there seemed to be very little difference between, really no difference, between the patients who were 10% or higher on the 167 trial, people who were 1 to 9% on the 250 trial, or people who had undetectable, which we consider less than 1% on the 250 trial.
Bottom line, though, is what other situations
well,
can you use?
Yeah, so one would be, I think EGFR staining is obsolete. The second would be in combination with chemotherapy. Obviously, since the label is as a single agent, that it cannot be promoted as in combination, either in second line, third line, first line, whatever. That being said, there's no good reason why the combination of panitumumab and chemotherapy would be any less active than the combination of cetuximab and chemotherapy. It's just this is the way the drug was developed. The one set of data that we have was the 09 trial, which I presented at last year's GI ASCO. And that trial was originally IFL plus panitumumab. And this was, once again, before bevacizumab had been approved. So it's now considered an obsolete, very toxic regimen, but was then the standard of care. And in roughly about 20 patients, it was too toxic, that combination, and with very high incidence of grade 3-4 diarrhea. The trial was amended to then look at FOLFIRI plus panitumumab. In both of those studies, I have to say that the disease control rate was roughly about 75% to 80%, which is what we've seen with cetuximab trials as well. So that, in a very small number of patients, seems to be reasonable. I think it is important to realize that targeted therapies have toxicities. And I think the 09 trial brings some of that out. Not only do EGFR antibodies cause rash and other skin toxicities, not only do they cause hypomagnesemia, but they probably do also increase diarrhea, especially in combination with chemotherapy. That was seen on the BOND trial. That was seen in the combination of irinotecan plus cetuximab. In the 09 trial, like I was saying, in Alan Vinook's trial that he presented, the one I mentioned earlier that he presented at ASCO this past year, that if you look, there's roughly about a 15 to 20% incidence of grade 3-4 diarrhea, which is a little higher than you would expect. And even if you look at the single agent, there's a hint of some diarrhea. I don't think it's something that is necessarily dose limiting, but I think it's something that all clinicians have to be aware of, that when you add chemotherapy to an EGFR antibody, that you do increase the risk of diarrhea a little bit, and I think you have to be aware of it.
Where are we in terms of predictors of response to these agents? You mentioned the disappointment in terms of EGFR. Mm-hmm. Anything that does look encouraging?
Well, first of all, whatever it is, as I said, it's not EGFR, and it's probably different than what was seen with small molecule inhibitors and lung cancer. EGFR mutations seem to be quite uncommon in colorectal cancer. There's a question about copy number. There's some controversy about that and correlation. The presence of KRAS mutations also seems to be important. There's some small series and there's some preclinical work saying that that may be a way to predict who's going to respond or who's not going to respond. There is a very interesting trial, which the data has not been released yet, where patients were biopsied before receiving cetuximab and looking for a gene signature. And we're anxiously awaiting that data because that may also be able to help us, determine. We don't want to treat people with a drug that, even with minimal toxicity, if it's not going to work. There's financial toxicity. There's opportunity cost of not using another drug that might be active. As I said, if only 20% of people benefit from an EGFR antibody, it means the other 80% don't. What we don't know, which is interesting in colon cancer, is whether adding other biological agents, such as bevacizumab, may increase that, whether there truly is synergy. There also is some early data about combining EGFR agents. And Jose Baselga has presented some phase 1 data, and this has been looked at in a number of different groups preclinically, that the combination of an antibody plus a small molecule inhibitor may have some activity. And it's very preliminary, but this dual inhibition, perhaps hitting several steps on the same pathway, may increase this 20%. So on one hand, we're trying to predict who's going to respond perhaps to single agent. On the other hand, we may have to look at other markers to find out if there is synergy with these other drugs as well.
What about trials in the adjuvant setting? Where are we right now? Where do you think things are heading?
Well, as you know, the standard of care in the United States and in Europe has been the combination of a fluoropyrimidine, usually 5-FU, in the United States, usually FOLFOX, based on the MOSAIC data, plus oxaliplatin. There was also the NSABP trial, which used a slightly different regimen that was also positive. We are awaiting the survival data, but the disease-free survival improvement was very strong, and that is the standard of care. There are two trials that are underway or being followed. One, another NSABP trial looking at bevacizumab, adding that to a fluoropyrimidine plus oxaliplatin for 6 months, and then 6 additional months of bevacizumab, and we can have a long discussion about whether that adds anything other than toxicity. There's also the worldwide AVANT trial, AVANT, all caps. And the AVANT trial, which is a Roche trial, is 3 arms. It's FOLFOX as the standard, FOLFOX plus bevacizumab or Zelox plus bevacizumab. And that trial had a closure for a few months within the last year or so because of a question about some increased toxicity on one of the arms. However, it was felt that there was not a significant increase in toxicity, or at least enough to change the trial. There was some additional monitoring added, and it will be years before we get adjuvant data. Obviously, people are looking at other targeted therapies such as antibodies, and I think that will be the next wave of adjuvant trials.
You know, the NSABP is talking about actually launching their next adjuvant study. I think they're calling it C11 before they even have the results from C08, looking at FOLFOX plus bevacizumab.
This is actually a window because it will take years. Adjuvant trials, by definition, take years because you're waiting for a large number of events. And remember, most people are cured with surgery. And then adding FOLFOX cures another perhaps 15 to 20%. So you're really trying to improve a relatively small amount. And so it takes years to get this, even to get disease-free survival. So I think that now is actually the time to look at other targeted agents. Because if the bevacizumab trials are positive, then it actually becomes more difficult again. So actually, I agree with that. And there are other groups that are looking at that as well.
And they are looking at adding one of the two antibodies to FOLFOX plus bevacizumab. How do you think they would stack up in the adjuvant setting?
Boy, that's a blue sky question. First of all, we don't know whether bevacizumab has any activity in the adjuvant setting. I mean, there really is no data. What we hope is that drugs that improve response rate improve survival in the adjuvant setting. I mean, that's the theory. And simply enough, hopefully you go down to zero cells. And that's the only way that I can think about it, that chemotherapy mops up getting down to zero cells. That's not always the case. For example, if you look at the irinotecan data. So on one hand, we've been talking about FOLFOX. If you notice in the metastatic setting, we were talking about irinotecan-containing regimens and oxaliplatin-containing regimens probably being equally efficacious, though with different toxicity spectra. On the other hand, in the adjuvant setting, there really doesn't seem to be a role for irinotecan. And there have been at least three negative trials with irinotecan, despite the fact that response rates in metastatic disease are higher. These trials are negative. So I don't think there's necessarily a one-to-one correlation. Now, in the bevacizumab trials in metastatic disease, almost all bevacizumab trials have shown, actually starting with Firuzquinib's original 5-FU randomized phase 2, have shown an improvement in response rate, which was somewhat surprising because this was supposed to be a static drug. So I'm hopeful that the bevacizumab trials are, you know, going to be positive. That being said, the phase 2 trials with chemotherapy plus anti-EGFR antibodies also seem to have an increase in response rate over what's been seen. So once again, I'm hopeful for that. This also may indicate another role for these antibodies, which is a limited role, but the question comes up about making unresectable liver disease resectable. Because one of the questions that's come up is, how do we cure patients? And the only way we cure patients with metastatic disease is by operating on them and cutting out resectable disease. And data that originally comes from Renee Adams' group in France, but it appears that patients who are made resectable with chemotherapy, initially with oxaliplatin-containing regimens, who are resected, have a chance at long-term cure. So the thought has been that if we can make more people resectable, that we may increase this pool of curable patients. That has not been proven, but it's a reasonable thought. And we'd much rather cure patients than treat people palliatively. So one of the thoughts may be that one of the roles for targeted therapies may be to increase response rates and make technically unresectable patients resectable. Now, one surgeon's technically unresectable patient may not be another surgeon's technically unresectable patient. So these are somewhat soft endpoints. But that's another place where, you know, adding or combining these drugs, you know, early on may have a role.
Is that a strategy that you utilize in a non-protocol setting? I've heard people talking about using chemotherapy and double biologic therapy in patients who are trying to get to a curative status.
You're exactly right. There's extremely, you know, little data. I have not actually done that off protocol. We have had patients on protocols with double biologics who went to surgery, which is a different discussion. But, you know, there are reimbursement issues, there are other issues. But I don't think there's any problem with a combination of, for example, 5-FU oxaliplatin and bevacizumab as being a very active drug. And it also makes the surgeon feel better when they see that the patient has not progressed. So they're sort of acting as a biological filter. What you don't want to do is you don't want to do a large liver surgery and 3 months later the patient has multiple relapses outside the liver. I think that the fact that a patient not only has the tumor shrink, which is a good prognostic sign, but also does not end up having metastatic disease makes the surgeon feel better for going ahead and doing it. You know, so in some ways, we're holding the hand of the surgeons. And to be honest, I can't say that this biological filter is necessarily a bad thing. That being said, there are also theoretical concerns about the effects of chemotherapy on the liver. There are also concerns about bevacizumab and wound healing. We routinely hold the bevacizumab for 6 to 8 weeks before liver surgery, 2+ half-lives, though we have no idea really how long you would have to hold it to have a decrease in wound healing. But I have to be honest, I don't think that that's really a big problem in a good surgical center. I mean, I have to say that I don't think that people should be operated on, should have hepatic resections or metastasectomies in places that don't do a lot. And this has historically been an American, more American than a European problem, where a surgeon says, I can do that, but instead really should be done, like I think like all surgeries, should be done in a place that does a large number of them. I hope in some ways that our success with chemotherapy doesn't embolden community surgeons to start whacking out liver metastases, because I think we're going to get into trouble that way. Another potential strategy for that would be also combining cytotoxic agents. The combination of 5-FU oxaliplatin and irinotecan, sometimes called FOLFOXIRI. There was another version of it called FOIL. It seems to have a high response rate, though in a randomized trial, it's been hard to show improvements in survival, but once again, does show an increase in response rate, albeit at the cost of increased toxicity, significant, particularly hematologic toxicity, which is not surprising.
How do you think the safety profile of bevacizumab is going to play out in the adjuvant setting?
Well, that's a really good question. And on one hand, in the setting of metastatic disease, where the patient, if they're not resected, has a 100% chance of dying of their tumor if they don't die of something else, is that we're willing to take a lot more chances. But as I mentioned before, you start out with a group of patients who may have a 60% cure rate, long-term cure rate with surgery alone. Then you add chemotherapy, which may have a 1% or 2% mortality rate, hopefully lower in experienced hands, but that's actually not the roughly 1%. Is something that's been seen in a number of adjuvant trials, but that at least makes sense because you're probably adding that 15 to 20% improvement in survival. So the question comes, you know, with adding bevacizumab. Bevacizumab, we know, has a roughly 1.5% perforation rate. We also know that it increases the risk of myocardial infarction and angina, as well as TIA and CVA. While the absolute numbers are relatively small, the relative risks are not insignificant. The other problem is, and this is something that we really don't know, is trying to individualize the treatment of patients. Because, you know, you have a patient who is 45 years old that you're treating adjuvantly with no cardiovascular history. There are a couple things going on. One, the chance of them having problems from a cardiovascular risk from bevacizumab is extremely low. Second of all, if you're right and you do increase the cure rate, the number of years of life saved is much. I mean, that person probably has a life expectancy, if they're cured of their colon cancer, 40 years. To flip that, an 85-year-old patient with multiple medical problems, I mean, this is some of the same calculus that you have with adjuvant in general, but the average age of someone with colon cancer is 65. A lot of those 65-year-olds have comorbidity. Still, the most common cause of death in the United States is cardiovascular. If they don't have symptomatic cardiovascular disease, a lot of them have asymptomatic cardiovascular disease. And I think we're still working out how to do it. I think the adjuvant trials are important, and I think that it's reasonable to wait until the adjuvant trials come back before routinely suggesting bevacizumab for every patient. I am a little concerned in the 6 months of bevacizumab that's been added at the end. When these trials were designed, that made more sense, and it was before this toxicity was really appreciated. And I'm even more concerned that we're adding 6 months of potential toxicity, and also it was before it was appreciated that bevacizumab alone was not perhaps as active. So less benefit, more toxicity. I am concerned about that in these trials.
You talked before about predictors of response to the antibodies. What about predictors of response to bevacizumab?
That is a really good question because I don't know of any predictors of response. You know, we talk about targeted therapies. We really don't know how to target bevacizumab. There has been some data, and this is not before treatment, there has been some data that hypertension, particularly early hypertension, in some of the trials, particularly actually in one of Hedy Kindler's pancreatic cancer trials, that early hypertension was a predictor for better outcome. which may be sort of an on-target. We know that hypertension is common. It is a VEGF pathway effect. And so in some ways that makes some sense. But as to really looking at it, I'm not aware of LDH being important. That data has not really been published as far as I know. I think it's been presented at least once that LDH in one of the analyses did not seem to determine whether people benefited from bevacizumab or not, but I've actually never seen that in published form. So there may be some differences between bevacizumab and small molecule VEGF inhibitors. Bevacizumab is, compared to most of our drugs, is an extremely well-tolerated drug. On the other hand, there are these rare toxicities. Obviously, you don't want to treat people who are not going to benefit. I think that this is kind of a regrouping time. We're learning how to use the drugs that we already have. I think it's really critical to be able to identify the patients who are going to benefit from the drugs. I think it's really critical to be able to identify the patients who are going to be harmed by our drugs. And I think that even more important at this time that we've been looking at the epidermal growth factor receptor pathway for 40 years. And colon cancer, I know that our lab has been looking at it for at least 20 years. The VEGF pathways have been looked at for not quite as long, but, you know, angiogenesis as a target has been around for 100 years, was sort of resurrected 30 years ago. The VEGF pathway has been looked at for 20 years. It is somewhat depressing that we can spend all this time talking about really fairly minor ways to improve the treatment of colorectal cancer. I mean, clinically significant, but we're not curing a lot of people other than by resecting or perhaps in the adjuvant setting. And I think what really cries out is the need for new targets. I think that's really what's going to be interesting in the future, and identifying those patients where those targets are actually important. Because I do think that the mid to late 2000s will be known as the end of industrial oncology, where all patients are treated the same. I think as we identify new targets, we will identify those new targets in subsets of patients. And hopefully we'll be able to design treatments and design trials to get those treatments approved in those subsets of patients.
You think that's really going to happen?
Better.
Do you think it's going to?
Yeah, I think so. That's what we do our work in. And that's what our laboratory work is in, trying to recapitulate the natural diversity of colorectal cancers in, you know, preclinical models. Because, you know, treating every single person with 15 drugs is not a viable model.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Colorectal Cancer Update.